You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Go for it, Jason.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another live edition of Spilling Ink. I am Jason Lavelle, the Jason Lavelle, and I'm here with my lovely co-host, Katie Salitis.
Hi, no Katie. Longer the grand high poobah.
No, you changed it, so I don't have to call you that anymore. And then also, Mr. Robert Cano. Hi, Robert. Anything? Nothing?
Hi, sorry.
Did I say your name right, Robert?
It's pronounced Cano, but that's Cano, fine.
Okay. I don't think I was that far off. Maybe I was. Katie, was I pretty bad?
Yeah, you were horrible.
Oh, damn it. Damn it. All right.
It wasn't that bad. I've heard worse, so you're good.
All right.
Name is always mispronounced. You did good.
It was, and it's such a simple name, but then I was looking, I was like, oh man, this could actually be trouble. Give me Stefanovich or something like that, and I'm okay, but
you'll knock that one out of the park, right?
How are you guys doing tonight?
Excellent. Ready to go.
Yeah.
I have nothing to complain about, so I'm good.
Okay, that's good. Well, yeah, you guys are both out west where, well, Katie, you've experienced a rare snow recently. So that was big news out in the Vegas way.
Oh, I know. It was awesome. We were out at 11:30 when it was really snowing. At 11:30 at night, my kids are in their PJs and jackets and we're all dancing in the snow because it's not something we experience ever. I think the last real snowfall was 2008. So I was like, these kids are not missing this. Come on, everybody, outside. Let's go. Play in the
snow. That sounds awesome.
Somebody posted video of Red Rock Canyon covered in snow. And I was like, what? We were hiking out there last year with Katie. I mean, it's a desert.
It is. Oh,
Rebecca. What? I said Cano, maybe. Or did I say Cano? Cano? You danced in the snow too, Natalie? Well, that's good. That's very good. All right. So, Katie, I have something for you to try. All right. You ready? Ayo.
What?
Ayo.
Ayo.
There you go. All right. I just wanted to see if one of you would do it. Robert knew what I was doing. He was just like, this fucking guy.
Okay. I was just going to leave that one alone.
Yep. Come on, man. We just watched Bohemian Rhapsody a couple days ago. And I'm still glowing.
Nice. I haven't seen it yet, so no spoilers.
It's cool. Well, it's about a band. That's all the spoilers I'm going to give you.
Yeah, I was thinking it was about Queen/Freddie Mercury.
Yes. Oh, you've heard of it? Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah. That was the only spoiler there.
One of my favorite bands. So you know.
Oh my God, they're amazing. So cool. All right, so before we get too in-depth into this show and have too many more comments from Rebecca Jonesy out there. Hi, Rebecca. I do want to tell you guys that Spilling Ink is brought to you by Book Branders. They are a very cool company, and they're a company that's made for indie authors and, you know, any self-published artist, really. What they do is they take all the crap that we don't really want to do, and they do it for us. So we write the books, and they can take care of the formatting. They can do the editing. They can do cover design and website development and all these things that I don't know about you, but I would just rather not do. And they call themselves your self-publishing concierge, which I kind of like. And I don't know what a concierge is, but I think that's a nice little tagline there. So, and Katie's worked with them before, and she has good things to say about them, right, Katie?
Yes, I actually am one of their publishing coordinators. So I help in the different areas of getting you signed up for all the accounts that you need. I do help sometimes with the formatting and layout of the book. But yes, the concierge is the one who goes out and finds the things you need and puts them together for you. And that's exactly what Book Branders does. They see what your needs are to get your manuscript to publishing. And they ask you, okay, what parts would you like us to handle for you? And that's what they do.
My name's Book Branders, and I'm the guy who can get it for you.
Yes, yes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Wait, there will be all the comics? They do laundry and clean the litter box? What? I don't know. I mean, you could send them an email. There might be an additional charge for that, but Katie, I'm sure, would come over and do that for you, Rebecca.
No, I don't do litter boxes. Sorry.
Well, that's a long flight for a litter box.
That is, yeah. Well, now that Katie has gotten us way off track already today, as she always does, guys, we know it. Robert, could you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are?
All right. Well, I am Robert Cano. There you go. And I am the author of The Suffering and The Dark Archer, both set in the same world. But The Suffering is a novella that just kind of gives a backstory to a character who is kind of in the shadow, but is also a major player throughout the entire arc that I have planned, which is big. And we're not there yet, so we're working on it. And then The Dark Archer follows a character that we meet briefly in The Suffering, named Bene. And he is a wraith throughout this story. And the whole purpose of his story is him trying to seek death, which for him is what redemption would look like. And so that is what he is trying to figure out in his own way. In my world, wraiths can be killed, but he is a special instance where he cannot. But I won't give you any spoilers as to why. So there you go.
Well, and in my world, and all the times that I've played against my kids, I choose the wraith and I always lose every time. And I don't understand how that happens. But so you do a lot more than write novels. You also write a lot of poetry too, right? Can you tell us a little bit about your poetry? Because I was on your blog today reading through some of it. And you kind of have this, I mean, you're kind of a dark guy.
I am.
You've got a dark feel about you.
I am a dark person, but I mean, I attribute a lot of that stuff to my childhood and to kind of the things that I dealt with growing up. You know, so there was a lot of darkness involved there, which wasn't all, you know, unicorn poop and rainbows and sunshine, right? And so I had to learn how to not only deal with that, but also let it go. And poetry was my method for letting it all go. And, you know, of course, then as we get older, you know, there's loves and loves lost and, you know, all those kinds of things that happen. And it's a reality that we pretty much all deal with. And so there is a lot of that too. There's a lot of the idea of loss of not just self, but also loss of, you know, those that we love and things like that. It could be a grandma. It could be our first girlfriend. It could be whatever, you know. And so a lot of that stuff really plays into my poetry. But if you read any of my stuff when I first started writing poetry, you'd see that it's grown up a lot. Because that stuff was crap, you know.
The idea of drawing from life's pain, it reminds me of a quote from Princess Bride, where it's life is pain. Anyone who tells you different is trying to sell you something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be. Well, and you know what that makes me think of is this is somewhat unrelated, but I was listening to an interview with Trent Reznor, who was the front man for Nine Inch Nails. Mm-hmm. Who were hugely popular in the 90s. And in the interview, he was talking about how those first two albums he thought were just absolute shit. And it was such bad writing, and he was embarrassed by the writing he had done on them. And, you know, as someone who was a huge fan back then, I was like, man, these were your biggest albums, though. There was so much hurt and just nastiness and anger in them. And now, of course, they're a very different sounding band, but it was interesting for me to hear, you know, this mega successful albums that he's talking about, him referring to them as crap. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, we do grow, you know, but
yeah. Well, you know, it's fascinating too, because I love Nine Inch Nails. And I didn't up until the point that I saw them in concert. Mm-hmm. They were actually out here at like the Austin Amphitheater, and we got free tickets from the military. And so I went to go check them out, And I went just because there were free tickets and some of the guys were going. That's literally the only reason I went. I didn't even like them at the time. I see them in concert and I'm sold. It's done. I am a fan for life now. Like, the Trent Reznor is genius when it comes to lyrics and stuff. Like, the guy is good. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I can see where he would say that his early stuff was crap and everything. But, you know, it's funny though, because he understands also that you grow up, you know, and since he has also produced for movies and, you know, done soundtracks and stuff for movies. And so it's very impressive, his resume. Yeah. And he's not the only one. I mean, there's Maynard from Tool, absolutely brilliant musician and lyricist. Like, I can't even understand sometimes how these guys do it, but it's out there.
Yeah. Well, and their brains are them. It's only one guy, actually. Yeah, Joe. Yeah, that might be true. You could have anybody with him. But yeah, you know, Maynard, too, is he's not the world's most likable guy, but brilliant musician. Brilliant writer, for sure. Yep.
Yeah. And busy too. He keeps himself busy between Pussifer and A Perfect Circle, you know, and Tool. Like, he keeps himself very busy, and he stretches himself, if that makes sense. Which I think is important as an artist. And it's not just music; it's everywhere. You know, we need to be pushing ourselves and stretching ourselves to become better than we were.
Well, and on your site, you refer to So you refer on your site to poetry as your kind of your true love. Do you ever think about taking that and trying to make music out of it? Because, you know, poetry and music seem so closely tied together.
I actually have thought about it. The problem is that my music background is very minimal. So I'd actually have to go and learn how to play something and be able to go with it from there. I do want to learn how to play piano at some point, but I don't have a piano and I don't have money for that. So, so I'm just going to like let that one go for now. You know, but you know, maybe once I hit it big, I can start doing that.
Hell yeah. Hopefully that's soon. That'd be awesome. Yeah.
And I'm sure you noticed that some of them had a really lovely sway to the way that I wrote the lyrics or the poems. And so that's something that I focus really heavily on, especially with my more classical forms.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I like formed poetry far more than free verse. And that's not to say that I don't like free verse, but I really like well-formed poetry. It's easier for me. It's easier for my brain to absorb. Mm-hmm. It really is. So, yeah.
I think that it's fascinating because a lot of the poets that I see nowadays are very free verse oriented. You know, they do a lot of the slam poetry. They do all that stuff. And once in a while, there is some brilliance. I will give them that. But it's not as much as they seem to think it is, unfortunately. Yeah. And I think a lot of the problem comes in where somebody just applies a thought to and put it on paper, and then they expect it to be like this groundbreaking poetry. And that's not how that works. You know, there is skill involved. There is time and effort and energy. You know, meter isn't taught when it comes to poetry just because they want to throw it out there. There's a logic behind it. There's a reason for meter. And when we're writing our novels, we also, whether we realize it or not, we also apply the same concept. There's a flow. Just the word choices, not just in the lines, right, the sentences, but also in the paragraphs, in the way that we apply all of that stuff. It's absolutely necessary.
Well, and you can actually zoom out on your pages as you're writing a novel. And sorry, my microphone keeps there we go. It keeps sliding way the hell away from me. But yeah, you can actually zoom out on your manuscript when you're writing a novel. And I encourage people to do this and look at how the paragraphs flow. And if you think of them as a poem, you know, where you've got stanzas, really, you do need to have breaks in there. You know, your paragraphs shouldn't be going on for half a page. You know, make them manageable. You know, make them something that, so when the reader looks at them, they're kind of consistent. They have a good flow to them. But that's, yeah, I love everything that you just said. It was beautiful, because really, you know, whether it's a poem or a novel, we are. Gosh, what's the word? I can't. You fill in. Whether it's a poem or a novel, we are
just, I guess, we're applying growth and skill to create something that people can universally relate to or enjoy. It's funny too that you say that too, because like I think about it, and I know that.
Oh, he's frozen.
You're frozen. Come back.
Come back. He was in the middle of a good point.
Robert, you're frozen.
Oh, yeah, hey. Sorry, guys. My internet went all crazy on me.
Oh, yeah. Go back 1 minute and start over.
I know, right? Sorry. Now I have to undo.
Good point. This is an absolute good point. As a formatter, yes, we do see the patterns in how books are put together. And as we're formatting them for the page, we're looking for those things. So yes, absolutely, Rebecca.
Well, yeah. And, you know, our voice throughout the novel, I mean, you could break this down as far as you wanted it to, you know, our voice should be like a music. It should have a rhythm to it, mm-hmm. that the reader gets used to, because when a reader reads you and then keeps reading you, it's because they like your voice. They like the way that novel was put together. It's not just the flashy crap, the sex or the violence or the plot. It's because they like the way you told it. So remember that. That's your, you know, that's your groove. And it's okay to grow and improve and change, but, you know, still keep yourself, because that's why people are there, I think. I don't know. I don't have readers, so I wouldn't know. Guys, I mean, maybe that's what it's like. Katie would know. Katie with your...
You, Jason, they just don't like
it. Nobody likes me. Nobody does. I write.
No, we all love you, Jason. Come on, now. You know that.
I'm just telling myself it's because I write scary stuff, and nobody wants to read scary stuff anymore.
I still take, like we talked about before we went live, that whole it takes 10 years to become an overnight success. I kind of believe that's what happens. You know, unless you've got some magic that has put your manuscript in the right hands at the right time. A lot of time it's just work, slogging through the muck, getting those words out, writing your stories, mm-hmm. and eventually it builds into something that becomes a success. And usually it's one novel becomes a success, and then people see everything else you've done and they appreciate what you've done.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we hope for. You know, that's what we're all looking for. And we were talking before we went on air, you know, and I had read that foreword by David Baldacci, who is a, you know, world famous thriller author now, has said that it had taken him 10 years before he wrote something that all of a sudden, boom, he was a superstar. And now all of his books are New York Times number one bestsellers. I like the cut of your jib, Jason. What's the jib? I don't know what a jib is, man.
Oh, what is that 20s era lingo there?
I think that would be jibe.
Jibe? I don't know. Joe, you're going to have to come on, man. You got to speak to me in the commoner's tongue. You know I'm common.
Oh no.
In the common tongue.
I think you've insulted Rebecca.
What did I say? What was I even talking about? I don't know what's happening here. Oh, yo, Rebecca, you crack me up. So I'm on an interview with Rebecca and Heidi for their show, and Rebecca's real quiet for a couple of minutes. I'm like, "What are you doing?" She's like, "I'm reading your book." I'm like, "Right now?" She's like, "Yeah, right now." And then I think she ended up reading 3 10,000-word novellas while we were in the interview. I'm like, "What the hell?"
That's a very Rebecca thing to do.
It is. It is.
Yeah. She just kind of like cranks it out. She's like, I'm just gonna read.
I got this. It's really pretty impressive. It is. But no, we were talking about taking a shitload of time to become successful. That's what mm-hmm. I was rambling about. Yes, yes, yes. I don't even know what you're talking about, Rebecca. What the hell is happening right now? I am not in the desert. Joe, I don't have a ship, unless you're referring to my glorious goatee. Is that like a sail? It's very nice. I put some beard wax in it just for the show, just for you, Joe, actually. But no, we all want to be successful. And we never know when it's going to happen. You know, it could take me 20 years to find something that's a big hit. Or it could be tomorrow. You know, mm-hmm. Robert could become a superstar next year. And that would be incredible. And there's the message, like, is hysterical. Yeah, I don't know what's going on here, guys. I'm sorry. But and there, I think that, you know, not only is there a lot of skill in what we're doing and a lot of hard ass work and in tears, lots and lots of tears and drinking. But luck too. I mean, we gotta get lucky. We really do. I've been trying this whole time to get lucky, and yeah, it's tough. What about you, Katie? Are you getting lucky?
No, not at all.
Robert, are you getting lucky, Robert?
I guess it depends on your definition. But
injuries.
Because as you are moving along, it's not about that overnight success. Yes, we want to get there. It's about the perseverance until we get there. You know, we all want that. We all want that big paycheck, and we all want that movie deal, and we all want that stuff, right? But seriously, though, how are we going to get there? You know, the reality is we can't quit. That's how we get there, is we don't quit. We don't stop. You know, and I tell people this all the time. I'm like, you know, the difference that between the success and the failure is persistence. You know, it's up to us to not give up.
Amen. I mean, that is the bottom line. You just keep going until that success happens. You just keep writing. Today I was talking to the library about just getting through the first draft, which a lot of new writers have a problem with. And the main point in that talk is just do it. You can't fix something that hasn't been written. Same thing with our writing careers. You can't have a career if you're not writing constantly and always putting out new work. It's just part of the job. So you have to do it.
Yep. I do exercises is what I do. So like I ended up writing a 55,000 word sci-fi novel.
Uh-oh. Am I frozen again?
Who froze? Did I freeze?
Yep.
Sorry.
You were saying you wrote a 50,000 word sci-fi novel.
Yes. And it all started with just one exercise. I decided to write a scene. I was like, okay, what's the worst thing I can imagine? And I will write this. So I wrote it, and then it just kind of grew. It took off on its own, got a life of its own, and just went. And so I ended up with this 55,000 word novel that's just sitting there and waiting. I mean, I keep being told that I need to submit.
Rebecca, shut up. I'm sorry, Robert.
No, it's fine. That's Rebecca for you.
See, I can't even blame Jason for derailing us this time.
No, that was all Rebecca. She's good at that.
Okay.
That's her lot in life.
I've completely forgotten everything you just said. Oh shit.
Yep.
Back on track, guys. Come on, back on track. Talking about working through novels and reaching success, not quickly.
Well, not quickly.
Yes, we don't want to get there too quickly.
You want that lasting success.
That's right. That's right. You want it to be really long and satisfying.
Yeah. There you go.
Definitely.
You know, I'm not there yet. I hope I get there. And when I get there, though, I'm damn well gonna appreciate it, though. That's for sure.
Yeah,
I am gonna appreciate it because this is hard work, man. And I'm like 40 years old, so this is a lot of hard work. Although I have only been writing for how long have I been writing, Katie? 2012. How long is that?
You've been writing for a good long time.
Seven years.
Yeah.
Okay.
if the 10-year rule applies, you've only got a couple more years to go.
All right, three more years. All right, I can stick it out. Well, and you know what? I slowed way down on writing because it gets discouraging when you're not selling a lot of books, but you're trying and trying and trying. And so I decided to kind of get into other things. Like I'm more into this show now, and I started a new podcast that I'm super into. And so I'm exploring some other avenues of, you know, success, you know, not avenues that are making money, but things that I can enjoy, because I feel like if we're enjoying our lives, then that's a success in itself. You know, mm-hmm. We still do need to pay the bills, unfortunately, but yeah. the enjoyment is amazing. But it's led to more weird, issues, problems that I didn't know that I was ever going to have in my life. Like, public speaking, like going to conventions and doing panels. And I set up this big showcase of authors at our local library that I'm going to be interviewing live on stage in front of an audience. I'm like, holy shit. I mean, I'm okay when I'm here, but this is my little 4x6 room where nobody comes and bothers me. And you guys are there, but you know, if I close my eyes, I know you're not really there.
thanks.
But but I'm extremely introverted. Quoth the Jason forevermore. I like it, Joe. I like it. I know you probably made that comment 5 minutes ago, but but no. So it's kind of like, how in the hell do I get out of my extremely introverted comfort zone and go and interact with real, actual people? And I'm wondering if you guys have any tips on this, because Katie, I know you've been doing this for like 40 years, but Robert, what about you? You're a young guy. You've got to have some good ideas.
Well, I appreciate you saying I'm a young guy. I'm only a few years behind you.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
I just look amazing for my age. What can I say?
You do.
there's my humility coming out. again, I'm not conceited. I'm convinced, guys.
That's right.
But I would honestly say, though, that it is hard. I mean, being an introverted and even doing this sometimes can be a little difficult. But I have found that if I'm with what I call my tribe, it's a lot easier, you know, because like with you guys, we can sit down, we can talk about stuff that I'm passionate about, things that I love, things that I enjoy, and that comes easy. What'd you say?
We were talking about pizza just now?
No.
Things that we love and enjoy?
Oh, pizza? Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Okay, go ahead. You're on a roll there.
Just ignore Jason. Derail. Mind is gone. No, I'm just kidding. Now I'm thinking about pizza.
Just not pineapple.
Just, well, no, of course not. That's heresy. But no, I mean, basically what I was just saying was if I'm discussing something I'm passionate about, if I'm discussing something I enjoy, it comes a lot easier, and I can actually do that. And I can even do that in front of people, and it comes fairly easily most of the time. I'll still get sweaty and I'll still get kind of, you know, heart palpitations, but I can handle that to a point, you know. But if I'm at a party, right, and there's 500 million people there, and they all want to talk to me, I am gone. Like, you know, I will disappear. I will find a bathroom or a quiet room. I will close the door. I will lock it, and I will just disappear. You don't exist. I'm sorry. You know, and it's crazy because thankfully, my wife understands this, and she knows that when I need to decompress, she knows how to just send me away and I can decompress. Sometimes that's just vegging in front of a movie. Sometimes it's music. Sometimes it's reading. But I can handle that, you know, and I'm very lucky to have someone who understands, you know, you need to go away. So yeah. What about you, Katie?
That's a real thing. The whole introverts needing to kind of reset. it's a lot of people confuse introvert with shy, and you can have a shy introvert, but you can also have somebody who's not shy be an introvert too. Mm-hmm. And it's that overwhelming sense of all of your energy being drained away by being around other people is what the introvert experiences. And if they don't have that reset time where they can kind of regain their energy, they can't function. And I'm very much in that same boat where if I'm giving a talk, if I'm doing something for a purpose, I can do it. I can do panels, I can do conventions, all of that. But if I'm at a party, I'm the same way. I'm going to go hide because I can't deal with that much just randomness of people around me. Mm-hmm. Whereas if, yeah, just like a panel, I know I'm there for a purpose. I have what I want to say planned out. I can answer questions knowledgeably. I know I'm helping people too, because I'm sharing my knowledge, and that kind of helps you get over that little mental block. But I guarantee you, after we close the show down today, I'm going to have a good hour or so of just nothing time to reset before I can function again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I want to
I want to give a shout out to your wife here too, Robert, because that's actually a big job, and you sound a good deal like me. And I really, no, I wasn't snorting coke. I was blowing my nose. I know it looks suspicious. No, but I have big time anxiety issues, and so anytime I'm in a social situation, it's kind of like 50-50. Is Jason gonna fall apart? And yeah. having a partner who loves you and understands you, man, it can be life or death, man. It really is, and mm-hmm. so that's awesome.
I think it really is. One of the tactics I use whenever I have to go to a party or something, and it, trust me, even with family, I have to do this, but I will basically like attach myself to one individual, somebody I can carry on a deep conversation with, because small talk is a killer. I will walk out of that place with a headache from hell. I can talk all day long as it's not small talk. Mm-hmm. As long as I can carry on a decent conversation with somebody, I'm not wasting my time. I can manage, you know, but it's not. And so it's that small talk and that, you know, in Spanish we call it, you know, cumariando, where you're just out with, you know, being a social butterfly. I cannot. I will lose my mind completely. I will just lose it. And so I attach myself to one individual that I can talk to on a deeper level, and I can walk out of that place and be mostly okay.
That's a good technique. I'm going to remember that, and I'm going to use that. And I agree with you on the small talk. And, you know, I've been recently stressing about is I'm actually coming out west to go to Phoenix Comic Con, or no, Phoenix Fan Fusion with Katie and some friends, which should be a lot of fun. But Katie keeps telling me all about how you jump up and you start talking to people and this and this, and you sell them books. And I'm like, oh my freaking God, this sounds like the worst possible thing ever in the world, ever. Like, I would rather be up on stage on a PA bullshitting with everybody in the convention than have to talk to one single stranger and try to convince them to try one of my books.
Right.
See, oh my God.
You're not selling your books. I've actually found going to Comic Cons, when I try and sell somebody my book, I fail.
Yeah.
I can tell you all about my book. I can throw my book in your hands. That doesn't really sell people. It's connecting with them on their level, which is what sells them. And what I mean is, if somebody is at Comic-Con and they've dressed up in cosplay, they're very clearly interested in a certain show or a certain style of fantasy. And would you stop that, Jason? And so I reach out to them based off of that. If I see a really cool costume, I jump out. I'm like, can I get your picture? What is that costume from? If I don't understand or don't know who it is, mm-hmm. or if it's like a Doctor Who I absolutely love, I will talk to somebody for an hour straight about Doctor Who without not once mentioning my book. But because of that interaction, they might look down and go, oh, what's this? Oh, here's my book. Take a look at it. But by the way, the 13th Doctor, you know, I'll just jump back into that. And that mm-hmm. sells books way better than me just trying to shove my book in somebody's hand.
Yeah. It's again, it's those passions, right? I think we need to be passionate about not just writing. You know, I enjoy other things. I enjoy video games. I play video games quite a bit. I raid on World of Warcraft, you know, with my guild, and I, you know, play Kingdom Hearts, and I'm, you know, playing through Kingdom Hearts 3 right now, and I'm playing through the Tomb Raiders again so I can get to Shadow of the Tomb Raider, you know, and I don't have time for this. So, but I love the games. I love the stories. They help not just with writing, but they help to kind of expand horizons, and they help with other things. And when I get to places, when I talk to people, I don't have to talk about one thing. I'm not a monolith, right? So I don't have to be, you know, trying to sway conversation in a different direction. And it's funny because, you know, I've actually, obviously, as authors, we do a lot of research, you know, even for fantasy, we do a lot of research. And so I got really high praise not too long ago from a doctor friend who read The Suffering. And she said that she actually had to skip a few parts because it was too detailed and too good as far as the realism that I went into with with that stuff. And so that was high praise for me in a way. that was really good. I had to skip it. I don't know. But it was one of those things where then, you know, we could discuss the medical side of things, and I'm not completely ignorant and I'm not an idiot to it. You know what I mean? Because then I can meet people on their level, which is amazing. And that I think that's part of the human condition too. I think it's fun to do that. And it's something I've always been good at ever since I was a kid, which is why I never got along with peers growing up. But I always got along with adults because I love to learn, and I would just ask questions and glean and, you know, offer up ideas and stuff. And, you know, once in a while I hit gold. So it was nice.
I remember one of my coworkers who I had, and I started working at a vet clinic a couple of years ago, doing tech work. It's really fun, rewarding work. I get to work with animals, which I absolutely love. Maybe that could be my passion, Katie, is animals. That's what I could talk to people about.
That clearly is your passion.
Yeah.
Maybe that is your passion.
That might work. I'll jump out from behind the booth. I'd be like, what do you think of this freaking cat?
You need to bring a service animal with you. Then that little thing. Look at my cute pug.
I like it. But then now it's kind of sounding like I'm a sexual predator or something like that. Like, here's a cute dog. Come to my booth. I don't know about that. I don't know if that's going to work for me, Katie.
Okay, no white bands with freaking money written on them. Don't do that.
Hey, you guys are the one picking me up. It's up to you if you bring the white van or not, I guess.
Free candy.
That's how we're picking you up. It will be in a white van. This is free candy.
Ice cream. It'll have a free ice cream on the side.
That's right. I gave a coworker a book that I had written a few years back to read, and it took her a long time to read. It took like a month to read it, and I didn't say anything because, you know, usually that means they haven't read it or they didn't care for it. I'm like, whatever. And finally she came up to me. She was like, so I got to this part, and then I put your book down for a week and a half because it pissed me off so bad. And then I finished it. It was good. I was like, okay, I'll take it. You know, if I can get some kind of reaction out of you, that's good, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah. It was pretty brutal. That was a gruesome one. Okay.
I think it is, though. You know, I think as authors, we know that we're not going to please everybody. You know, Rebecca's still mad about a certain pillar. And I'm okay with that. Like, you know, you be mad. That's fine. And so, you know, that's one of those things where I have to remember that's okay. I actually like to hear that kind of feedback. And, you know, some of my other friends are like, you know, why'd you do this? Or why'd you do that? Or why'd you, you know, kill off this person or what have you? And I don't know. Because that was part of the story. It had to happen. You know, it was like, loss. My book is not about happiness and joy. I'm sorry. It just isn't.
Well, okay. So I'm glad you brought that up. It was a perfect segue into my next thing I want to talk to you about, The Dark Archer. So I'm reading through your description. Oh, are you frozen? Are you still with us?
I can hear you.
Okay, cool. You froze for a second.
Sorry. So
I was reading on your blog about this, and you know, kind of dark high fantasy from what it sounds like, but also not just dark. I mean, it sounds like this is more about this character's suffering than anything else. I'd really like to know. Let's take a minute here and talk about this pillar. What is up with the pillar? Was the pillar not hard enough for Rebecca? Or
no, wow. No, actually, I can't really go into detail with the pillar without some bad spoilers. So I will just tell you that you don't see Rebecca get that mad about something unless it came from something Josh did or something that I've done specifically with that pillar. You know, but yeah, the
are you talking about Josh Robertson?
Yeah.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, apparently he and I are at the top of her list for, ooh, you know. Yeah. So we have to be really cautious about that now.
I see.
So as long as she stays in North Carolina and I stay here, we're good. But you know, if that distance should shorten at any point, you know, there could be issues. I don't know. But no, I mean, it's just one of those things where you're right. I write the pillar was too big. I had to hold up stuff, you know, that's what they do.
Oh shit. Oh, so your new book, not just dark fantasy,
Right, froze.
This sounds like it's going to be. It sounds like it's going to be really serious.
So far, it is. Yeah, I was looking at it and I was like, dude, there's no laughter. There's no jokes. It's kind of almost too grim.
Well, I can hear it to expand on that for anybody who might be watching, because in the comments, Rebecca described it as grimdark. You want to describe for us what grimdark is as far as a genre?
Well, okay. So I don't even know if I call mine grimdark, but I think others would. And I think the reason why is less because of, what's happening and more because of how deep I go into the psyche of the individual.
And
as a matter of fact,
it's me.
Yeah. And so as a matter of fact, the reader's review, comment or the actual review that they put out talked about that. It talked about the fact that it was very psychological, very emotional. You know, another individual who's read the book said that I'm like the Nicholas Sparks of epic fantasy because I focus on the emotional pool of the characters. And it hits, my whole point was I'm going to make you feel this on a very, very deep, very visceral level, right? And it wasn't because I was trying to be mean or anything, but because I think I wanted people to understand kind of that side of the darkness. Like for me personally, right? I grew up with dealing with depression and PTSD from the time I was three, which is not a good thing, but that's what I had to deal with. And that has fueled everything that I have done since then, right? Thankfully, I didn't become a social pariah to the point that I went off on killing sprees or anything. I just kill off my darlings in the book. But there is that element, right, where I, because it's such a huge part of me, I delved, like I dove headlong into that. And I didn't even realize it at the time. When I was writing The Dark Archer, I had no clue that I was putting that much of myself into it until months after I had written it. Like, it was scary how much I put of myself in it. And, you know, and then in the suffering, there's elements of that too. That is all about one person's suffering. And then you go into the Dark Archer and it's like, wow, this guy's suffering too. You know, that's all this guy knows. And I think in some ways the whole, you know, write what you know kind of came out in that aspect. But the other aspect is that I ended the Dark Archer with hope.
That, I don't know if I mentioned this before on here, Katie. No, you're still there. It just made me think. It really did. And I did an interview recently with Michael Brent Collings, and he wrote an article about why he loves horror and how horror is the genre of hope. And I know we're not talking about horror here, but we are talking about terrible things at times, horrible things at times. And kind of how he described it as great horror or great, really dark fiction is going to kick you around and leave you in the gutter, but then it's also going to show you the way back out. And I think that that's a really important thing to give our readers and also to give ourselves as the authors and as the people that are going through this, because you hit it right on the head. You put a shitload of yourself into your writing, whether you want to or not, it's going to happen. And you've also got to be good to yourself. I think that's a really important thing to do. I miss Rebecca's comment. Could you put that comment back up there, Katie? Or is that not a thing you can do?
Is that the one you want or the one before it?
Yeah, well, that's what I was looking at. I just wanted to read what Rebecca had said.
Yeah, she was talking about the Dark Archer there, what it's about. The happy ending we're looking for is the main character's death.
Yeah, that's dark.
yeah. Well, I mean, he's a wraith. That's kind of the thing, is that in my world, a wraith is nothing but suffering. And why would you want to live like that for eternity, right?
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. So his happy ending would be to release himself from the pangs of that and from the necessity to feed on other people or other life, because that's what he has to do to function. And that's the thing that he doesn't want. You know, he's holding on to what remnants he has of his humanity, and he's holding on to it with all he's got so that he can hopefully still be good, or be at least a force for good in this world. And I mean, it was crazy too, because I was really concerned about making him a Mary Sue. Like, it was getting to the point in the Dark art or in the.
Oh no. Oh, what a way to freeze. No.
Yeah. Right. It like froze all weird. I was like, dang it. Why is it doing this? It's probably because I'm so far away from the other room.
You know what? It reminded me of when I just reading your description of what he was going through in the book. And hopefully you don't take this in a bad way, because I certainly don't. But do you all remember that that book called Interview with the Vampire?
Mm-hmm. What do you mean, remember? How can you not remember that one?
Right? I love Anne Rice.
So, Louis, who is played by Brad Pitt in the movie, that's him. Mm-hmm. He turned into a vampire. And so as a vampire, he has to drink blood. He has to take lives, but he was tormented by this. And so immediately when I'm reading your description, that's what I'm thinking of Louis and just how torn apart he was by this life that he now had to live. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, man, what a phenomenal story this is going to be, because I love that, you know, because you know, the character has conflict built right into them. Mm-hmm. It's part of their character. And so how are they going to get through this book and start to resolve this conflict? And I really love that idea.
Yeah. I love that too. And that was kind of one of those things where I was thinking about it from even a realistic point of view, outside of fantasy or vampires. Right. And how often do we have to deal with that kind of stuff where, you know, outwardly we have to pretend let's say that we're all okay. You know, I mean, most of us have kids, right? So things aren't going well, but we have to put on a brave face because we have to still function and we still have to move forward and we still have to make it through the next day, or at least try and find a way, but without them thinking that it's the end of the world, right? Even though it might very well be for us during that moment. And that's hard. That's a really, really hard place to be. And it's life, you know? I mean, I tell people all the time, I'm like, yeah, I write fantasy, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have to deal with real stuff. That's one of those things that we have to think about. And I think that any kind of fiction, whether it's fantasy or mystery or horror or anything like that, it allows us to explore different aspects of life, but without the realism, I guess, of maybe, you know, really, really dark memories or something like that. You know, but it allows us to explore things in a almost safe environment, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You're like you're in the mirror dimension. Yeah. Do you feel like you feel better when you finish writing a book like this? Do you feel like it's therapeutic in some way or not really?
Yeah, I tell people it's cathartic because it allows me to release everything. So very much in that Aristotle sense of catharsis, you know, I'm able to throw it all out onto the paper and then I'm good.
You've essentially exercised your demons without harming anything physically.
And then we have to deal. What if it harms me, though?
Well, it was your choice to read it or not.
Wow.
Damn, dude. Damn. All right. All right, then. Oh, well, on that note, Stacy, there's a therapy technique, narrative therapy, and that does just what you described. Yeah, for sure. Well, and, you know, based on what Stacy said, what do you guys think about Instagram?
That was a really hard segue.
Really, really. That was interesting. Good job. Well played.
Instagram is very painful. It is. It's horribly painful to use.
Well, we were talking before the show about how it seems like social media just kind of sucks now. You know, we try to get the word out and reach people and talk to people, and it's like half the time they don't see us, and so, you know, some of us are going to Twitter, and some of us, oh wait a second, it looks like people still want to talk about writing stuff. Look at this, interesting, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. Well, Katie, you know what? I'm actually pretty pissed about that pillar too, to be honest with you. Now that we're thinking about it.
Oh, did you read it?
No, is that in The Suffering?
No, it was in The Dark Archer.
Oh, right.
Is to now read The Dark Archer, learn about this pillar, and Rebecca will be creating a bitch session for us all so that we can complain directly to Robert about the book.
I can take it. Bring it on.
Excellent. Now, is there any naughty stuff in The Dark Archer?
Naughty? No.
Okay.
No. It's I don't. I mean, there's a slight love story, okay. But it's interracial.
Okay.
So yeah, it's between an Inklet and Bene. You kind of get a sense of it through, you know, one of the humans from there and the other human, Perna, from across the sea. But that was more friendship and just, you know, friendly banter and stuff. But the relationship between the Inklet woman and Bene is kind of the more fascinating / love story, but it's not overt and it's not really a big thing. I think for me, I write it. I don't mind doing that kind of stuff really, but I just, I will have a tendency to shy away from it if I can, just because it's not necessary if it's not the main focal point of the story.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, that is just part of what gives them depth later on, I guess, but it's not really a necessity in the moment. And so I'll put in a subversive, you know.
Frozen again.
I like the faces though. Every time you freeze,
you have good frozen faces.
I get weird frozen faces. Yeah, I'm sure you guys do too, by the way. So it's I'll look at it
when we move this over to YouTube and post it on our YouTube channel. Those are the ones that YouTube will select as the thumbnail pictures. The most ridiculous face every single time.
Every single time. Well, at least they have a sense of humor.
Oh, all right, Katie, you're up. I tried to do the Instagram thing. Nobody liked it. Let's do something else.
You know what? We can save Instagram for another time because we're actually running out of time for today's show. So let's put a pin in that, and we'll make that next week's first topic for you to derail us on.
Oh, okay. Well, I like that. I like that. So, Katie, we didn't really get into how do you feel about pillars? I mean, how do they make you feel?
I have no opinion on pillars.
You don't have an opinion?
I'm pillarless, so... Oh. I guess I'm going to have to form an opinion and then I can join the bitching squad.
You know, I have a pillar out in my backyard. It's like a concrete pillar. It's in the concrete garden. That's what we call it, with just a bunch of like broken statues and shit.
Why does it have to find me?
I've got a concrete alligator out there too. He's pretty cool.
That also does not surprise me.
No, but it's a very small, thin pillar. It's nothing that would actually support anything. Not like your pillar, Robert. Yeah. It's an inferior pillar.
You know, I have a pillar. Love that. Sure. Well, let's go random a little bit. Pillars.
Oh, you know what? I have an idea, something that I would actually like. If you're up for it, Robert.
Okay.
Would you read us one of your poems?
Sure.
Yeah, we've got just a couple minutes left, so.
Well, which one do you want me to read?
You pick.
Oh, I pick. Pick Reader's choice.
One.
Is there something about pillars?
No. No pillars in these. Well, actually, I have a poem called Pillars of Creation.
Oh, there
yeah.
You. I don't have it like handy though. I have to find it. That was kind of buried a little bit. you guys want a long one or a short one? You want to discuss one that makes you discuss things or, you know, what do you want?
Whatever you feel like pulling out of your hat, man.
Okay. Well, then I will do.
I haven't seen it, Steve.
That one either. I'm going to have to look into that one. Although I did start the Umbrella Academy recently. That's one we could talk about in an upcoming show.
I'll look first.
All right. I will do Tale of the Whippoorwill's Sorrow. All right. Can you guys hear me? Yeah. All right. So the Whippoorwill despairs alone. Unto the wind he sings. Beyond the sorrow's hidden throne, he is no longer king. I look upon the clouds of day from quiet fields of grass. I come unto the cabaret when all the day has passed. Some lively jazz released to winds attempts to drown my pain. Another night now lost to sins, the arms of sweet Lorraine. There is no sleep to have this night, no longing may return. The heart that lost its blessed sight within the hope that burned. No longer do I shed my tears, but still I mourn Christine, that alcohol can hide my fears and bury souls unseen. The morning comes again, I sigh, returning to the fields. I'm seeking hope within the cry I've longed to see concealed. I look upon the sky once more, I close my eyes and fade. Into the clouds I fly, unsure, my broken wings displayed. The whippoorwill despairs alone, unto the wind I sing. Beyond my sorrow's hidden throne, I am no longer king. The end.
I like it.
Very nice. Like it.
Oh, tell us about the poem.
It was actually one of my favorites, written in Common Measure, but it was a it was kind of one of those poems that you write, not really sure what is going to come of it. And then it just kind of, you know, wrote itself. And for me, it had like really beautiful imagery, you know, not just with the whippoorwill, not just with the loss of the wings or being able to fly, but the uncertainty that's within it. And so that was kind of one of those things that I tried to incorporate as I wrote along. A lot of fun. It was good stuff.
Yeah, beautiful. Very, very nice. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I love hearing good poetry. Do you, I know you've got a lot of poetry on your site. Mm-hmm. Do you have a book of poems? Oh, wait, hang on. I gave one of Kenna's poems something. Oh, wait. Do you have a book of poetry?
Not out right now. I'm actually in the process of putting some together for A.L. Mengel's Parchments Press. He wants to publish a book of my poetry because he loves my poetry so much. He's like, just put it all together for me. He's like, I'll put it out there. And so I told him that I would do that. So I might try and do that over the summer. And just work on that. Because, I mean, I do love writing poetry. I wrote one actually yesterday, posted it up on Instagram. It was super dark. I didn't even mean it to be, but it came out that way because I think that's just me.
Well, read us the dark one. I want to hear that dark one from yesterday.
Oh, you want to hear the dark one from yesterday, huh?
Yeah.
Hold on. I'll pull up my Instagram. Just give me a sec. It was pretty short. All right. It was a cruelty in the moment, a dance with hell, personified, a devil of choosing, unknowable, a light once, in the darkness, for my darkness, a lie, told, believed. My faith faltered, and quietly I fell, beneath the might of an unseen smile.
Cool. I like it. Very cool.
Yeah. So, see, I write free verse too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm very particular about free verse. I don't think that it can just be done. You don't just throw something onto the page and it works. Like, it has to have something to it.
Yeah.
But that's just me, I guess.
Yeah. I wrote a lot of poetry in my my college years, and it was all shit. And our professor absolutely hated anything, any formed poetry. I mean, he was big into Bukowski, and he actually toured with what was his name? I totally lost his name now. A big time beat poet, not Jack Kerouac, but someone else like him.
Oh, okay.
God dang it! He's super duper famous. I don't know why I can't bring up his name, but anyhow, so he hated anything with rhyme and anything with real form. So yeah. I had to do all free verse kind of stuff, and it was just all terrible. I mean, I am so shitty at it. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing with free verse is that it doesn't have to be bad. I think a lot of people they just don't know how to form it. You know, and that comes with time, that comes with practice, and that comes with practicing to get better, right? Like, I can't stress that enough with people. I discuss, because I edit too, and so I discuss with writers all the time. I'm like, what is it that you're trying to say? How is it that you want it to be said? Because that is what's going to make your voice, right? And my job as your editor is to make your voice the best it can be. Yeah. And so, you know, that works with poetry too. Like you can't have one without the other. You really, if we're writing, we have to be pushing ourselves. We have to be making ourselves better every day. You know, I didn't publish. I've been writing now almost 20 years, and I published last year, right? But I wanted to find a voice. I wanted to find who I was within the midst of everything, right? And then I get accolades from some, and I get, you know, not so accolades from others, right? Because my writing is heady. It's too highbrow, right? These are words that I've been told Tolkien-esque, right? That was used. I took that as a compliment, but it was actually not used as a compliment. But it was one of those things that I had to really understand where, you know, okay, so this book is not for that audience. This book is for this person who thinks at a higher level, right? And that's not to say that anybody else is dumb. It's just to say that there's a specific individual that I'm trying to find, right, with my writing. And so if you want highbrow and you want heady and you want complex sentences that aren't just going to give it away, look me up. I got your back. So that's my pitch, right? So, yeah.
We're all going to appeal to different audiences for sure. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're about out of time here, but Rebecca has requested that I read one of mine. And Rebecca, I just happen to have one stuck in a folder here that I just found for you. All right. And Rebecca, you're going to like this. Okay. All right. Got to mute Katie here a minute. Okay. So this poem is called After Sex. After sex, the excruciating type that's equal parts love, guilt, and torment. Bodies lay in their separate channels, radiating heat. Hearts beat, lungs stretch, and minds remain restless. And that's it. So there you go, Rebecca. The first and last poetry you will get out of me.
Very good.
I thought at first you were going to go the humorous route. So
No, you did not.
That was actually pretty good.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you. See, Katie, somebody likes me.
Oh, there you go. You found your one person.
I found my tribe. All right. Well, Katie, you better roll us out tonight since I've just been failing at everything.
Okay. No more talk of pillars, though. All right, guys.
I'm going to write a pillar poem.
And no random pillar picks, please.
Yeah, that would be good to avoid. I know I don't want any.
You just made this a thing now, Katie.
Random pillar picks. Yeah. Hashtag that.
Pillar. There you go. All right. So there's your assignment for all of our viewers out there. And we'll be back again next week. We're here always at 5 p.m. on Facebook. We've been doing lately. So we're going to stick to this format. We're going to do Facebook on our 5 p.m. live show, and then we will move it over to our YouTube channel within about 24 hours. So if you missed the show live, you can always find us on our Facebook page or on our YouTube channel. And Jason is making it go to our podcast, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So we will be everywhere. You can always catch up on our shows later, but please feel free to come back. Join us next week for more author silliness with Jason. And thank you again, Robert, for hanging out with us this week.
Thanks for having me, guys.
We'll see you guys later.
Good night, everybody.
Night.
Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.